Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Mandy Wiener, as you know, is a journalist and author, a talk show host and columnist, also a friend. So it is just absolutely fantastic to chat to you. And I'm very, very excited that you've just launched your new book. And it's such an interesting topic, because I was the whistleblowers, and I was thinking we are socialized to hate whistleblowers. You know, when we little, we say, you know, snitches get stitches, and don't tittle-tale, and, you know, it everything around telling on is considered bad. And of course we get that, but, you know, that obviously translates to adulthood, doesn't it?
It really does, and that's the concern, is that, as you say, nobody likes a tattletale. Mm. So there is this view in South Africa, particularly, where whistleblowers are seen as impimpies or pariahs. Mm. They're problematic, mm. they are trouble. And nobody wants to touch them because they create waves and they speak up about things that people are trying to cover up. So there is definitely that culture. We don't celebrate whistleblowers in South Africa like perhaps they do in the United States or the UK. You know, in the UK, there was a movie made about Catherine Gunn. Mm. In the US, you know, Edward Snowden, everyone knows and who Brockovich, he is, Daniel Ellsberg, yeah, yeah. and Aaron Brockovich, exactly. So we don't have that culture in South Africa. And yet, in South Africa, whistleblowers are absolutely fundamental to the fight against corruption.
Yeah, because where would we be in South Africa without it?
Well, just look back at the arms deal, for example. Mm. We wouldn't know about the arms deal and the extent of it were it not for various whistleblowers who came forward and exposed the wrongdoing, the bribes that were paid, the backhanders, all of that. And the same with state capture now. There have been a series of really formidable whistleblowers that have come forward about state capture, who've gone to the Zondo Commission, who've gone to the media to expose this billions of rands worth of malfeasance and fraud and wrongdoing that we would never have known about were it not for them.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, because when Angelo Grisi came here into studio on Chad Thomas's show, I came in to meet him because I wanted to get a sense of the guy, and I was totally ambivalent because I thought it's an amazing thing that he's doing this, but then why is he doing it? And it's so important that he's doing it, but do I trust what he and the whole way through I was completely torn, and until I thought to myself, well, why does it matter what I think about him? But somehow we do try and make peace with our own feelings towards whistleblowers.
I think a lot of people think that whistleblowers are supposed to be angelic and virtuous and beyond reproach, and they're coming forward for altruistic motives. That's not always the case. In my view, there's a spectrum of whistleblowers where on the one end, you do have people like this who speak out because they've just got such a strong sense of moral justice, and it's black or white. Somewhere in the middle, you've got accidental whistleblowers, people who realize that there's something going on.
Mm, this, quiet, you say that become, in the book. It's a spectrum, really.
Yeah. And Angelo Grisi is a whistleblower. He, on his own admission, spoke out of self-preservation. He admits that he was involved in wrongdoing. He wasn't the corruptor, but he was responsible for paying the money over on behalf of Gavin Watson, so he says. But whatever his motives, he remains a whistleblower. He has still come forward with information. If it were not for him, we wouldn't have that footage, that knowledge, all those details about the bribe packs and the booze and the birthday parties for Nomvula and the security systems for Gwede and all of that stuff. We would never have known about it were it not for him.
Yeah, so his role is absolutely vital to that. When you started this process, and I think I recall reading it somewhere, you weren't necessarily going to look at a whole lot of different whistleblowers. Is that right? Did that evolve?
Yeah, so it started with one whistleblower who approached me, who wanted to do a book, and that almost happened, but in the end, that whistleblower decided to stay anonymous. But having met with that person, I realized the enormous costs that whistleblowers pay. And it made me start looking around and speaking to whistleblowers and meeting with them, and I thought this is something that really needs to be highlighted. the role that they play, but also the cost that they pay as well. And that's how it evolved into this book. And this is by no means an exhaustive list of the best whistleblowers or the most prolific or whatever it might be. These are just stories that were interesting to me that I thought needed to be told.
Take us through the process.
Well, it was very much looking at the human narrative. So we know the stories. We know the headlines about Trillion and McKinsey and regiments and about ESCOM and about ETOLs and all of that stuff. For me, it was about the humans behind it and their journey and their experience. So it involved convincing these people, firstly, to sit down and talk to me. And many of them were extremely reluctant, so it was an exercise in patience. And then just sitting with them and listening to what they had to say about the trauma and the torment and the cost and the journey. And that's what I tried to do. You know, my colleagues are really good at following the money and looking at shareholdings and bank accounts. Useless at that stuff. I can't read a bank statement very well. I really wanted to look at the human cost and the people behind it.
Commented that South Africa might have legislation to protect whistleblowers, but in fact, it really isn't particularly pragmatic or useful.
Not at all. And I spent a lot of time looking at this because we have got legislation. We've got the Protected Disclosures Act and other laws as well. And it was amended in 2017 to make it slightly broader, but it still remains very much an employment type law. It works in theory, but not in practice. So there is a lot that needs to be done to better suit the whistleblowing process. And I propose either something like in the US, which has the False Claims Act or the Lincoln Law, where a whistleblower can get a percentage of the money recovered, or alternatively, like they have in the Netherlands, a whistleblower house, which is a Chapter 9 organization that is run like a Chapter 9 organization, but is funded by government, and thus provides support to whistleblowers, be it financial, psychological, security, all of that.
And Mandy, you spoke about how you focus on the human aspect in your book. What are some of the ramifications for you that stood out where someone lost, you know, completely everything, you know, financially, emotionally? Like, what was the one case where you thought maybe this person shouldn't have, you know, gone ahead with this?
So there were two instances where people were killed for blowing the whistle, which is, you know, obviously the ultimate cost. And that was the story of Moss Parkway in Rustenburg, who was a councillor who spoke up about corruption. And that involved the mayor of Rustenburg. And the other one was Jimmy Mokhlala, who was the speaker of the municipality in Mbombela, who exposed corruption involving the building of the 2010 World Cup stadium. There are such parallels between these two stories. Both men, loyal ANC caders, civil servants who were meticulous and just really good at their jobs, who came across this corruption. They made a noise. They didn't back down. They were threatened, and then they were both gunned down outside their homes in 2009. And in both of these instances, I spoke with the sons, who in both cases are just these phenomenal human beings who have such maturity and such perspective and speak about how they have been left this legacy of truth and how they understand what their fathers did, but obviously they are carrying the costs of it. And then other whistleblowers that I spoke to where their marriages are broken down, they have got PTSD, they suffer the trauma, they're unemployed, they're unemployable, they have cashed out their pensions, they are really just broken from their experiences. So it is a very heavy cost to bear.
I think this question is a setup. I think Mandy is amazing. Where did she go to school? That's definitely, it's an unsigned,
it's such a setup.
But it's such a setup of a question. Do not answer that because I don't trust that question one. But Tony says, hi Mandy, I don't usually read nonfiction, but I have been loving all of your books. So that is from Tony. Well, I can tell you, Tony, it's because of Mandy's style. She writes like she speaks, so you can, it's almost conversational. It's almost that you're sitting and having a conversation about the subject. Is that deliberate, by the way, Mandy, or is that your just has that just evolved to become your style?
No, I think something that I always tried to do was I really love narrative nonfiction. Mm. So I particularly love like that style of, you know, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, kind of narrative. Mm. If you look at South African books like Peter Harris's In a Different Time, that kind of thing. Mm. And Andrew Harding has just written the most exceptional book in the style called These Are Not Gentle People about, well, I can't say murder, killings in Paris recently. Right. So I love that style of writing. And I'm always very wary not to make nonfiction like a long newspaper report, which many people are guilty of doing. I want to make it compelling and interesting and take the reader on a journey. So I do try and do that. And for me, it's also about having access to people's voices and letting them talk, because then it does feel more like a conversation.
What's interesting and always been interesting to me about your particular style, and I think it's not only about your writing, but I think it's your talent, is that you form relationships and with people that sometimes are difficult people, and you've spent a lot of time in with very, very, excuse me for saying, unpleasant people and people that have engaged in really unpleasant stuff. Yeah. But somehow you earn their trust and see, knowing full well that who you are and what you're going to be doing. How do you manage that?
It is often a very delicate situation to manage. But I think what it is I try very hard not to be overtly judgmental of people. And I find that what often happens with journalists is that they take a position and that's it. Mm. And they decide, well, you know, I'm not budging on this. This person is wrong. They're evil. Whereas I really want to sit down with people and understand what they are thinking and get them to talk and give them a platform, which people don't often do. And listen, I get a lot of criticism for that too. Plenty of people think that I give people a platform that I shouldn't give to and that I'm too generous. But I do have this tendency to see the inherent goodness in people, regardless of what they've done, which can be problematic sometimes.
I was actually going to ask you that question, because you, and I know you off air and outside of journalism, and you are an incredibly positive person. Even in our darkest times in South Africa, you recognize what was going on. You're certainly not naive of all people, but somehow still have a very positive outlook on things. And is that I'm assuming is your approach to people.
Very much so as well. And I try and be positive, and also, you know, particularly in our community, Howard, I do also feel a great responsibility to be, a kind of, I don't know what the word is, but a beacon in a way, because people often joke, like, when Mandy goes, we know there's a problem. Right. You know, so, I mean, my friends joke about that all the time.
Yeah,
but I do feel positive, and I feel a responsibility to be positive for the community, and not just in a Pollyanna kind of way, but in a realistic kind of way as well. I'm not naive about what's going on. I fully appreciate people's frustrations and anger and cynicism and all of that. But I also feel that we need to be responsible as active citizens and play a role instead of just complaining. Mm, so that's something I speak about a lot, in a positive way, about finding a way to harness all of that anger and rather turn it into something positive and practical that we can contribute.
Well, it's also interesting you mentioned community. You've never hidden your Jewish identity. It's something that you're proud of, you're open about, but you've managed to draw a line on certain subjects. And I think if you didn't do that, it would have severely impacted on your career. That's just my sense of it.
I mean, this week is a perfect example, isn't it?
Welcome to my world. What? Yeah.
Yes. Look, I mean, I follow it all very closely. I have opinions. I try not to make them public because I don't feel it's my place to do so. And I'm very proud about my Jewishness and my role in the community. But I try not to get involved. maybe some people disagree. I have had people say that I shouldn't be so reserved about my position, but that's a decision that I've made, and I think it just works out better.
Yeah,
for me.
I think it was 100% the right. I mean, I've told you that before. I think it's the right decision, because otherwise it does impact, and it's easy for anyone else to say, but it isn't their career, and it isn't what they're doing every day. Unsigned says, have you ever experienced anti-Semitism in your work?
Never. I've never experienced it, which is amazing. Interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's because I'm very open and I'm very proud about being Jewish.
Absolutely.
And I've listen, on that earlier question about what school I went to, I mean, I didn't go to a Jewish day school. Mm. I grew up in Polokwane.
Yes.
And I was the only Jewish kid in the province when I matriculated, literally.
And yet I
never experienced anti-Semitism then either. And I think it's because I've always been so proud and so open about my Jewishness. And in fact, it's been almost a curiosity for people.
And I think that is the point, is if you are open about something and don't try and hide it, then there's very little for somebody to actually attack you on. It is a point, it does become a point of interest rather than anything else. Mandy, before we are out of time, before I let you go, where can we get your book?
It's available at all good bookstores.
It really is. I mean, I've seen it.
In the boots of the car, of my car. No, I didn't know. I have had people ask me that. Definitely not. You can go to the bookshop.
Yeah, I was just going to say. I actually couldn't believe you were saying that, because I thought, oh, have you completely lost your mind?
Because I know people would find me at like the Norwood Pick and Pay and
yes.
say, can I have a book? No, go to the bookstore or you can buy it online.
Absolutely right. 100%. Mandy Winner, thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Awesome conversation, and good luck with this book.
Thanks so much.
Be
and
well.
Good luck to you too.
Thanks a lot. Not that I need it.